Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. We're just days away from the November midterms where Floridians will vote on at least a dozen ballot amendments, state representatives, their senator, and a new governor. On Tuesday, we spoke with candidate for Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez. She's running alongside Republican Ron DeSantis. Today, we hear from the Democratic running mate alongside Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, Mr. Chris King. Mr. King was a candidate for governor himself during the primaries and championed a platform of promoting greater economic equality, improving the state's healthcare system, and holding sugar companies accountable for their impact on the environment. Mr. King now joins us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Mr. King, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Lewis, thanks so much for having me back.
Let's start with the stuff that's been going on in the news. And I wanted to start with a major national story that broke over the past week. President Trump announced that he wants to end the practice of birthright citizenship guaranteed in the Constitution through an executive order. What have you heard from Latino voters and other immigrants in the state while on the campaign trail about that announcement?
Well, Lewis, this is one additional example of what President Trump has done over the course of the last several years to divide our nation and to essentially feed red meat to his base to keep people very, very frightened. And so I think people are once again frightened by this. The concept he's brought out is frankly unconstitutional. It's not going to happen. And that's why leading Republicans have had to stand up and say this is just not appropriate to even be having this discussion. But it is yet another example of a president who seems to take every opportunity to try to blame immigrants for perceived slights that he or his base feels. We just don't believe here in Florida, running for governor and now lieutenant governor, that this adds any value to solving real problems.
Now,
and so we're staying focused on our issues.
Now, immigration, of course, is under the purview of the federal government. But if you win under Mr. Gillum and your administration, I wanted to know about the role that you're going to play in advising law enforcement when it comes to the issue of immigration. Now, we kept hearing the issue of sanctuary cities, which is not a real thing anyway. But how does your administration handle immigration issues when dealing with the federal government?
Sure. Well, Lewis, first off, we don't believe that law enforcement, local law enforcement, should be playing the role of ICE agents. We're not trying to turn our state into that kind of a situation. However, you know, we don't have sanctuary cities in Florida. This is a concept, again, that has been advanced by the president to pit people against each other. What we need at the federal level, and that's comprehensive immigration reform. That is the big idea that solves so many of these debates and these discussions. Of course, Governor Gillum and Governor Gillum to be and myself would honor the laws of the land, but we want to do it in such a way where we create a culture here in Florida where people of diverse backgrounds feel protected and cared for and safe.
I wanted to move over to the deadly shooting at the Little Squirrel Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Now, South Florida, as you know, has among the largest Jewish populations anywhere in the country. What does your administration plan to do when it comes to, and I know this is a big question, but the issue of anti-Semitism as it's permeating across the internet, I mean, how do you tackle that? Or is it really just about saying, okay, we've got to look at security at not just synagogues, but schools and places of worship?
Well, Lewis, this is a growing problem across Florida and across the nation. You know, in my very first speech running for office, I talked about the rising tide of anti-Semitism. When Richard Spencer, as you remember, came to Florida, came to Gainesville, the University of Florida, to promote this bigotry and white nationalism and anti-Semitism, I was there protesting and saying that's not who we are. You know, I think the first thing we have to do is we have to stand beside our Jewish brothers and sisters in these moments and say that we will not allow this to advance, to prosper, to continue. You know, in the aftermath of again, another tragic shooting, you know, I was reaching out to my friends across the state. And it's a frightening time for many in the Jewish community as they see this language growing. And a Governor Gillum-to-be and myself would do everything in our power to fight back against this rising tide.
And really, though, how do we deal with that issue of the political discourse that we see growing in the country? And it's fueled by, these hateful actions. For example, I mean, not just in Pittsburgh, we had the pipe bombs that were delivered by Cesar Sayoc, who was arrested here in South Florida. But I mean, really, it is still freedom of speech to say even hateful things. How do you combat that? And again, how do you change the political discourse that we've seen kind of going in that direction?
Well, you know, I think leaders have a responsibility to be very careful in their language and to try to leave a legacy of bringing people together, not tearing people down. And I think when you look at Mayor Andrew Gillum and his race in the primary and now in the general election to be Florida's next governor, you have got a leader who is in every way trying to unify people, trying to lift people up, trying to lift ideas up. Unfortunately, we've gotten into a time in our national discourse where it seems that so many people running for office or are in office are spending more of their time trying to tear other people down and trying to deceive and distract. You know, one of the things that to me was so unfortunate in the gubernatorial debates here in Florida is that Ron DeSantis in the first debate lied 21 times, in the second 22 times. And that kind of strategy to confuse people about even the basic truths is what is contributing to, I think, this coarsening of our culture. And I think the thing we can do about it is set an example when we win.
You know, Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis are very different on the political spectrum. And regardless of who wins, there's going to be a large portion of Florida voters are going to be very unhappy about this outcome. So, you know, how do you reach across the aisle and find that compromise in policy and ideology, not just with Republicans in the legislature, but even their voters? How do you reach across and say, we may be different, but we don't have to be enemies? It doesn't have to get ugly.
Well, Lewis, this is a challenge we are really excited about having the opportunity to lead on, because we think, you know, even though our politics are so divided right now in the nation, we think there are areas of great consensus where Republicans and Democrats and independents can come together to do big things. I'll give you just three examples here in Florida. I think there is a growing consensus that we have underfunded public education across our state, and it is contributing to not really building the workforce of the future. We're hearing that from Republicans. We're hearing that from Democrats. And we have a plan to do something about that. That's why I think we're going to have a lot of Republican support for that plan. Or take the environment. Right now, we know all across Florida, we have some pretty glaring issues when it comes to our environment. And we think there is great consensus forming for new environmental safeguards and rules and regulations and commitments to try to build a more sustainable state. I think healthcare is another area. Most Floridians, Republican and Democrat, are not satisfied with the fact 2.5 million people don't have access to a doctor here in Florida, and that the emergency rooms have become the healthcare of last resort. It's too expensive. It's not efficient. That's not the way it's supposed to be. And we think we can make progress on that.
All right. Let's say, I mean, for example, look, chances are, we don't know yet, but chances are the Republicans are going to hold the House and the Senate in Tallahassee. So if the Gillum King ticket wins, I mean, you're going to get a lot of pushback. Governor Scott, a Republican, got a lot of pushback from Republicans in the House and Senate. You know, how do you foresee working with the Republicans in the legislature to try to get, you have some big ideas they're already not happy about?
Right. Well, first, you know, I think we're going to do very well next Tuesday. And, you know, I think we're going to see some really wonderful victories on the House side and on the Senate side that will make, I think, this consensus building even easier. But we're going to reach across the aisle and try to find common ground wherever we can find it. The interesting thing in Florida and the way we've set up our government here is that the governor really has tremendous amounts of authority to change culture here in Florida through the appointment process, through bringing the right people, the best and the brightest, into government service at all levels. That's something we think we're going to be able to do in a way that hasn't been done in years. And then we're going to find those issues where Republicans and Democrats can come together and agree, and where they're not willing to work with us in a reasonable manner, we'll take it to the voters. And we feel like our vision works across the aisle.
But I'm going to pick one in particular. I mean, you know, because some of the things that Mr. Gillum has talked about, his critics on the other side have said, wait a second, how are you going to pay for that? And one of them, of course, is teacher pay. So, right there, I mean, again, how do you find that common ground? How do you think you're just going to have to take it to the voters?
Well, you know, I think that's an area, again, where folks on both sides of the aisle are seeing we got a problem. You know, we are, let's just kind of get to the brass tacks. We've got 45th in the nation when it comes to teacher pay. Our teachers are 45th in the nation. They're paid $12,000 less than the national average. We've got more and more people leaving the profession. We have teacher shortages all across the state of Florida. These are Republicans' children and Democrats' children that are facing this reality. And so we have a vision. We have a big idea to try to create $1 billion to put towards teacher pay and early childhood education and vocational and technical school. And we're going to be taking that to our Republicans in the legislature. And if they are not interested in that, they got to show us where they're going to get that money. And I think they'll find that our idea is pretty reasonable.
I'm talking with Lieutenant Governor candidate Chris King. He's running on the ticket alongside Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum to become Florida's next governor. Mr. King is joining us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Just to mention, we did talk with Republican Lieutenant Governor candidate Jeanette Nunez earlier this week. And you can go back and you can hear that interview. Just look it up, WLRN/programs/sundial. Let's talk about some of the issues. You know, I want to tackle as many as I can here in this time. I want to talk about school safety first. What adjustments, if any, would you recommend to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act in the next legislative session that's coming up, if you win?
Sure. Well, you know, there were things in there that we liked. There were things we disliked. You know, the concept, as one example to your question, of putting more guns in public schools, that was not something that we saw as sustainable. I think what a Governor Gillum would attempt to do that addresses school safety, but frankly addresses the safety of our places of worship, like we saw in Pittsburgh, or our movie theaters, or pretty much across the board, is we need real common sense gun safety reform in the state of Florida. We need universal background checks. That's something that is very basic. We need a ban on assault weapons, the type of weapons that have been used in so many of these tragedies. We don't believe, Mayor Gillum says, you know, if you've got a weapon that can shoot 60 bullets in 60 seconds, that is something you shouldn't have in civilian life here in the state of Florida. We think those are the types of things that are going to protect us as it relates to our schools, our places of worship, or our movie theaters.
But if I can, I want to stay on the schools. What did you think of the part of the Safety Act that looked at the resource officers? Are you happy with that, or is there anything else we need to look at in that area?
Well, we certainly would love to see more resource officers. We certainly would love to see more guidance counselors. But the challenge here goes back to the last question, which is, the legislature has not been funding our public schools in a proper way. You know, even one of the biggest business groups in the state of Florida, the Council of 100, just came out with a new big report where they said we were 46th in the nation in the quality and investment in our K-12 public school system. And so school safety is just a microcosm of that, where we don't have the funding for guidance counselors or resource officers or the basic technology that we would need in place to keep our kids safe. So until we're willing to get honest and have the political courage to say we need to find new resources for K-12 public education, we're not going to do any of these things well. I think we're the only one in this race with a vision to bring new resources to public school, and that's a big difference that the voters, I think, have an opportunity to make a vote on.
All right. So, I mean, I'm going to stay on that with what you just said. We talk about education, and this is one of the big pitches by Mr. Gillum. He mentioned it on this program. He's obviously, you know, pushed it hard during the debates. It's about the starting salary for Florida teachers, getting it up to $50,000. Obviously, the criticism, as you know, is that the state doesn't have that in the budget. to bring that up. And so, of course, one of the things they've tried to pin on your campaign is, well, that means you're going to try to bring in a state income tax. So, mm-hmm. All right. So how do you respond to this? And really, again, I come back to it. How do you pay for that?
Sure. Well, let me make it very clear to the voters who are listening. There is no interest in a state income tax. That is something the Constitution would have to be changed. Mayor Gillum has never said that. He's not interested in that. Chris King is not interested in that. What he has said is to create this new resource that he would like to advance a raising the corporate tax that the wealthiest corporations in the state of Florida would pay. 97% of our businesses wouldn't be affected, but the very wealthiest would see their corporate tax rate go from about 5.5 to 7.75. What that would do is create almost $1 billion. The Republicans have said this would bring our economy to a halt. That could not be further from the truth, and I'll tell you why. Because those same corporations who would be paying this additional tax would still be paying less than they paid under the Governor Scott administration over the last 8 years, because there was a big event in the intermediary time. They got a huge tax windfall from President Trump's tax cut. So this would not impact the economy, but what it would do is allow us to invest in our public schools and our workforce of the future. And most business folks across the state know that is the number one thing we can do to create a 21st century economy.
Let me move over to the environment. This is a key issue in your campaign when you were running for governor. It was the focus was on the sugar industry and its impact on the environment. So if you win, what's the plan? Do you challenge? Do you try to work with the sugar industry in cleaning up Lake Okeechobee, in restoring restoration of the Everglades, and also in the algal blooms that we're dealing with right now, which is from the runoff that comes from Lake Okeechobee? I mean, what's the plan?
Well, we got to do a little bit of it all. First, we got to elect an environmentalist. That's a key point here that I've argued as somebody I think that has a lot of credibility when it comes to these environmental issues based on my track record. We only got one guy running for governor that believes that we've got to address climate change, who is willing to talk about science and the power of the best environmental practices to be implemented across the state government and the state of Florida. That's the first place we start. Before we talk about the reservoir south of the lake or cleaning up or new regulations on development and water quality north of the lake, before we even get there, we have to, I think, agree to the values. And the values here is we need a governor who wants to be a leader in sustainability and environmental excellence. You know, Ron DeSantis voted against clean water laws 33 times while he was in Congress. He got a record of 3% from the League of Conservation Voters as it related to his environmental record while in Congress. And yet he sought to win environmental voters by claiming that he would be the best force for the environment. Well, most people know even the Everglades. The Everglades' greatest threat is rising seas, climate change. And yet Ron DeSantis is not willing to talk about that or much more have ideas to address it. And so I think there's a lot we can do. It won't happen overnight. We were just, Lewis, in Fort Myers, of course, down in southwest Florida, just 2 days ago. We had a giant rally, Mayor Gillum and myself, with the senator from Oregon, where we addressed some of the hardest environmental questions that are out there from a community that has been devastated by these toxic algal blooms. And I think what they saw that night and what we have been able to demonstrate is that this is a ticket that is going to bring fresh new leadership to environmental issues in this state and is the best for it.
And you talk about climate change, and you know, here in South Florida, I mean, from Palm Beach County down to the Keys, this is a big issue for us. Sea level rise, we're already experiencing. These are counties, though, that are already working on resiliency. But how do you convince lawmakers in Tallahassee that there has to be a resiliency program for the whole state, not just for one region, and that there's got to be money put into these kind of programs when you've got people, as you know, they don't even want to say the word?
Well, I think it's a very exciting argument to make. I mean, I'm hopeful that the governor-to-be, Andrew Gillum, will empower me to help make some of those arguments. Because I see it. Look, I'm an entrepreneur by background. I believe in the power of business to do good things. And I see this climate change and rising seas not as just this big, scary problem, but this historic opportunity to really reinvent Florida's economy or add to it as it relates to building the types of companies and products and services that address it. And I think that could be very exciting. And so many in the business community, some of our most sophisticated leaders, recognize that infrastructure development, what you called kind of the climate resiliency programming, is incredibly smart for our economy and creates a big lift for the communities that invest in it. And so that's something I think we're going to have. We're going to have a lot of folks that are going to be eager for that, those types of conversations.
I did also, staying sort of with the environment, I wanted to ask you, I mean, we had last year Hurricane Irma was very devastating for many parts of the state. Hurricane Michael laid waste to parts of the Florida Panhandle not long ago. Do we need to revisit building codes? And this is an issue that is going to be very expensive to tackle and also can put a lot of homeowners in a tight bind, because if we do have to change them, then a lot of folks are going to find themselves in a situation where, well, you know, having to bring their homes up to code may not be a possibility.
Well, Lewis, you're exactly right in the sense that Hurricane Michael, I have toured the Panhandle, and just last week was in Panama City and Chipley and Mariana and other places. And the destruction was hard to even appreciate unless you were there. And many people, obviously, from South Florida who have been through Andrew or other storms know what this looks and feels like. And it is bad. And this will be the challenge to the next governor and lieutenant governor to rebuild those communities. And your question about housing is going to be an essential part of that. More than just building codes, the challenge of Florida in the next decade is the fact that we have a housing crisis, and these hurricanes make it even harder and more difficult. Those our friends in the Keys, for instance, are still fighting back in terms of their housing stock, and then now in North Florida. And so we are the ticket that has a plan to address our housing crisis and to invest nearly $1 billion in public and private monies in one of our great big economic catalysts. And we think that that will also be a part of addressing our challenges in North Florida.
So I'm going to finish with this. We're down to the last few days before the election, and the Quinnipiac University poll said that about 2, maybe 3% of Florida voters are still undecided. So you're talking to them right now. What do you tell them? Why should they pick a Gillum King ticket?
Well, I would appreciate that. I would tell them that, you know, here in 5 days left, I've gotten to know Andrew Gillum over the last 20 months. You know, I was running against him for 18 months, and in running against him, I came to care for him and like him and admire him. And I believe he is an unusual leader who has an ability to do things here in Florida that we haven't had a chance to do in a very long time. I believe he's the type of leader where people will feel this election. They're going to know who's their governor after this is done. And what we would have the opportunity to do under Andrew Gillum in the areas of public education or healthcare or environment will benefit all Floridians, Republicans, Democrats, in such a way that Florida could be the type of state that people are talking about as a front of the pack state, as doing innovative, exciting things that are bringing people from all over the world to Florida to do these things, as opposed to lagging the nation in so many of our vital indicators. I think that's the promise of Andrew Gillum, that it's not just about the wealthy and well-connected anymore. He's standing up for everybody, and that's why people are getting so excited about him as our next governor.
He is the lieutenant governor candidate, Chris King, running on the ticket alongside Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum to become Florida's next governor, the election coming up next Tuesday. Mr. King joined us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Mr. King, thanks again for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Lewis.
I also do want to mention that we did speak with Republican lieutenant governor candidate Jeanette Nunez earlier this week. You can find that interview as well at WLRN/programs/sundial. Well, right now you're hearing the Latin Jazz Menu, our live from the 305 band wrapping up the month. You're going to meet the band's leader, Eduardo Lease. That's coming up next on Sundial. back to Sundial on WLRN. Argentinian-born Eduardo Lis, who you're hearing now, has played in jazz groups from Toronto to cities across Europe, but has found a home for his music here in South Florida. The classically trained percussionist started his group, the Latin Jazz Menu, in Miami just 6 months ago and recently played gigs at Le Chat Noir in downtown Miami. They have a show this Saturday at Havana, USA in Davie at 8 p.m. Lis's unique style incorporates traditional jazz standards with Brazilian and Argentinian percussion instruments. Now, he's found inspiration in groups around Miami like Locos por Juana, Spam All-Stars, and a lot more. Now, we recorded videos with the band, so you'll be able to see on our Facebook page and Twitter, WLRN Sundial, them performing. Now, I started the conversation with Eduardo by diving into his time studying at the conservatory in Argentina.
In Argentina, it's very cheap or free to see classical music. So being a student at the conservatory, we used to go very often to El Teatro Colón, which is a big opera theater. And they would sometimes play just symphonies, sometimes opera, sometimes, just music, instrumental music. Doesn't have to be opera, but... So we got to really see a lot of things. We go way, way up there. We call it El Gallinero, way, way up there. And so that was we really listened to a lot of classical music of all periods, not classical in the sense of orchestra. But also Argentina is, well, there are things that are from Argentina and there are a strong influence of the music of Brazil in Argentina. It's always been. So that we have... You can see a lot of, I mean, obviously the how would you call it, the Hispanic rock or rock nacional. And so we all grew up with that as well. So it's all together at the same time. You'll go and see, Beethoven, and then you'll go and see a rock concert or a blues concert in a stadium or whatever. And also we get bands coming from Brazil. So we're exposed to Brazilian music. And of course, also to American music and British music, they would always go and fill stadiums. To this day, they still do.
And did you also see a lot of jazz?
And jazz as well. We had at the time that I was there, and I know today they do that as well because I have some friends that do play jazz there, even like a big band. I have a good friend that plays there classical music as well, but he has his own big band. And so we used to go to jazz clubs and see the jazz cats.
Did you see more like the American jazz, or was it because you said a lot of Brazilian groups would come in, more the Brazilian jazz?
I would say both, but in the when Brazilian people would come, it would be more like a bigger venues. But if you go to a small club, and I'm talking about maybe 30, 40 people, small clubs, there'll be the Argentinian the local jazz musicians, and there will be some really amazing musicians playing very, very, very late into the night. Like sometimes you go there, they say we start at 10 and they wouldn't start until 1, and they'll play like 1 to 3 after their gigs, and some really, really good jazz players.
Because I talk about the jazz, and I'm curious how you describe the differences between like say your typical American jazz and the Brazilian jazz, because it's very different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do you describe that difference?
It's like on a different topic. So when I was saying that I see in the jazz clubs in Argentina I'm talking mostly like kind of bebop, maybe a little bit of funk and things like that, and sometimes some Brazilian jazz, some Brazilian music with jazz, but the Brazilian jazz, as far as the rhythms compared to the American jazz, is the American jazz is based on swing, on swinging the notes, and that kind of triplet feeling of do be do be do, while the Brazilian jazz comes more like from Brazilian music, mostly from the bossa nova, because that's where the harmonies come into Brazilian jazz. And it's more of a straight feel, so it's more like ta 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 ta. So it's not ta 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 ta. It's more like straight. We call it straight eights.
brought a traditional Brazilian drum with you.
It's a traditional Argentinian drum.
Oh, that's an Argentinian
drum.
Yes,
yes. Oh,
okay.
That's why. So this one is called a bombo. This is a traditional instrument from the gauchos. So it's an instrument that you find today in every time you see a small group, which is usually two guitars, and the percussion is that instrument. It's the bombo. I call it like kind of like the best of recycling, because it's really a hollow tree. This one is sometimes now they make it industrial, but this one is really it's a one piece hollow tree. The rims are made of wood as well. So normally when you're just playing music, it's a very quiet accompaniment instrument. So it's just like. So yeah, I wanted to incorporate this as part of the song because the song has the basic rhythm of this malambo, which is this. Usually this accompanies the boleadora as part of the show.
And it looks, I mean, the surface, it looks so, I mean, not what I'm used to seeing in a drum.
Mm-hmm.
It looks soft. You went from Argentina to Canada, right?
Yes.
What led you on that journey?
Mostly the idea of expanding, musically expanding and studying jazz. So I really wanted to get a different perspective on music. And I mean, obviously that goes together with when I left, it was like 88. The situation in Argentina was, not that now, I don't know if it's any better, but it was hyperinflation at that time. Everything was very difficult. So I thought I had a chance, and I had at that time somebody living in Toronto that could help, and then one thing led to another, and it was it just worked out. At that time, it was I really wanted to. I mean, and I saw the things, the universities, which in Argentina we have universities, but all very classically oriented.
And you traveled. I mean, you've been, you know, just Canada, United States, Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, you know, what are some of the little things you picked up here and there that have really added to, you know, who you are as a musician?
Yeah. I think I'm very, I don't know, it's hard to say one thing, but there are things that I remember. I like when things have like a strong cultural background. But still, having said that, for example, I mean, I have one experience that I always remember that in Europe to have, I happened to be on a St. Patrick's Day, and it was in Holland, but there was an Irish pub, and it was full of people, and people would just pull out their guitars and violins, and they will all like sing together, and I was just like, that's something that you don't see in Argentina, and I don't think I've seen in Canada either. And it was just amazing to see, like, I don't know, 20, 30 people that would just interact, and somebody, they will play, and they will drink, and they will play again. And it was the atmosphere of, it was so strong, and the music was I love Irish music. It was was very strong. And the same you can feel with jazz. Sometimes in a jazz club, you can feel it with Brazilian music when you're and I used to play with Brazilian musicians in Toronto, and I pretty much paid my graduate school doing that, because we used to play in Brazilian clubs for like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and they would play music mostly. It was a lot of dance music. It was samba. It was samba nova. It was some música sertaneja that they called. It's the music from the Northeast, and that's also a strong experience when you see people that are really into the groove.
Talking with Eduardo Lis, he's behind the jazz Latin group Eduardo and the Latin Jazz Menu. Lis moved to the United States from Argentina as a young adult and came to Miami in 2006. He's also an elementary music school teacher in Broward County. So it was what, mid-2000s, right, when you got to Miami.
Mm-hmm.
What was the appetite like for Latin jazz at the time when you got here?
It's good. I think it was good, and it's still, I think it's a little bit better now. There used to be, there were some clubs that are not there anymore, but there are some new clubs now. And just having some important names like Paquito and Arturo Sandoval being kind of part of the Miami scene, and now we have some other names that are New York, Miami, I think it helps a lot. So there are some of the other things that I loved about Miami were the bands that were mixing Latin music with like funk and hip hop, and I thought that was, and there are quite a few bands that are doing that, and I thought that was really unique and
yeah,
cool.
Was there a group or two that you mentioned that were really doing that a lot?
Yeah, well, one of the first ones that I saw live was the Spam's All Stars. This is very cool, and it's something that I haven't really seen anywhere. But in a way, so what I'm trying to do is something different from that. I wouldn't mind doing that. That's a great music. But really, if I have to be true to myself, what I really can contribute to the music scene is the type of Latin jazz, and I like to call it South American jazz. So I'm trying to. Really, if I want to have my voice heard, is to use what I know, what I studied, and what I have experienced in jazz, mixing it with Brazilian elements and Argentinian elements.
I mentioned a second ago, I mean, you're a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so you're a music teacher. And I'm wondering, you know, that's got to be really, really fun for your students. You're probably introducing them to a lot of these different styles and sounds.
Yes.
How are they, you know, what's their reaction? What how do they enjoy it?
Well, I have, I teach elementary school. So I wish if I was teaching band, I'm sure I could do that, some of those arrangements or some things. Even though I heard band teachers that they in Florida at least, they do a lot of things that have a Latin feel or Brazilian feel. But in my school, for example, I have a drum group, and which I do with mostly fourth and fifth grade students, and we actually have. I try to do. Everything that I know, and it's also more fun for them. So it's not only, for example, Brazilian music. We actually do. I have instruments, like I have repenique, zurdos, tamborins, all the traditional Brazilian instruments. I'm looking at traditions, but I'm always really looking for new fun ways to make sounds and to do, to do rhythms with different things. Fun for me and fun for the kids.
So what's next for you with the band? What's happening next? Is it releasing more new music, playing more gigs? I mean, what's the goal for you?
The band, really, I started putting it together in June, right after, well, as a teacher, I get a little bit more time in the summer. That's the only time, really, I get any time to be able to sit down and look at songs and, you know, putting the charts together and hopefully writing new music. So my goal is to get jazz festivals and jazz clubs and keep working on my music. So getting new music, maybe by next summer, hopefully start recording some new material.
Talking again with Eduardo Lisi, is behind the Jazz Latin Group, Eduardo and the Latin Jazz Menu. And you can find out more about his group and their music and even watch some videos on our Facebook, WLRN Sundown. Eduardo, man, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And you can see Eduardo Lisa in the Latin Jazz Menu in Davie on Saturday night, performing at Havana, USA at 8 p.m. If you know a band locally that would be good for our Live from the 305 series, or you're a musician yourself, we want to hear from you. Tweet us at WLRN Sundial, or go to our Facebook page, or email us, sundial at WLRNnews, that's 2ns.org. Well, still to come, today is the beginning of an important holiday, not one known to many in South Florida. We're going to tell you more about it next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today marks the first day of Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. According to Mexican traditions, on this day, the souls of the deceased are said to come down from heaven and reunite with their families on earth. Our associate producer, Alejandra Martinez, is Mexican and from Texas, and she's been celebrating Day of the Dead since she was a little girl. Now, when she moved here, she asked me if I knew where people could celebrate Day of the Dead, and, well, I failed her miserably because I had no idea. So she went on a search to find somewhere where she could find a celebration, where people are celebrating it, and she went on to report of her experience for WLRN. By the way, you can hear her full story on our website, WLRN.org. She joins us now, though, to talk about a little bit more about Day of the Dead and where to celebrate it in South Florida. Ali, welcome.
Hi, Lewis.
You know what, real quickly. You know, I've always heard of Day of the Dead, but I didn't know anything about it, and I kind of probably was a lot like a lot of people. I just put it together with Halloween, but it's very different.
No, it's completely different from Halloween. Day of the Dead, or Día de los Muertos, is a Mexican tradition. It comes back from, like, Aztec. Those are the original indigenous communities who kind of cultivated this tradition, and it's a mix of Catholic and those indigenous traditions. In that day, what we do is we honor the deceased. We honor those who have passed away. And a way that we do that is through these things called ofrendas. So these are altars that you create where you put photos and you put flowers, marigolds called cempasúchiles. That's how you say it in Spanish. And you put, you know, candles and just gifts to those who have passed away as a way of remembering them and honoring them.
And you've been celebrating this basically most of your life.
Yeah.
You post it up on Twitter, and I've retweeted it. It's up there on we got to put it up on Facebook, too. This beautiful picture of you from 2015, and this is the picture we see from a lot of people where they have their faces painted.
Yeah.
Describe what is being painted on your face.
So one of the most important symbols or most significant symbols that you see is these calaveras or calacas, and those are women and men who paint their faces all white, dark, black circles around their eyes.
Like a skull.
Yeah, like a skull, exactly. Yeah. And they have like all these decorations, and basically it's kind of making fun of death. You know, you paint it and you're just like, death is supposed to be, so they teach us that death is something normal. It should be part of, like, this should be something that you should be comfortable with. And this is kind of what we do for kids. You know, we paint our faces, we are dead for that day, or we're welcoming those who have passed away.
So this is the first time you're celebrating it without your family.
Yeah.
So you come here to Florida. You've never been here, but you're looking for where people celebrate this, if anybody does. You have a lot of Latino, groups here living in South Florida. This is mostly, though, Mexican tradition.
Yeah. So one of the big things was, okay, there's a huge Latino community. They have to celebrate Day of the Dead, right? So I keep asking around, and, you know, I asked you, and you didn't really know where it was celebrated. So I was like, what's going on? Let me search for this Day of the Dead celebration. From what I've gathered, you know, my time here, you've told me, Homestead is a big Mexican population. Well, I found that, shockingly, I didn't really find a lot of things in Homestead celebrating Day of the Dead besides, you know, just restaurants with decorations and offering, like, discounted foods or so forth. And I found this Day of the Dead celebration in Fort Lauderdale, of all places. Yeah.
And who's running it? That was the thing that was fascinating about your story.
Yeah. So I went to this ofrenda workshop, the altars that you do for the day of those who have passed away. And I meet the man who's leading this, and he's been leading it for 9 years. And I'm like, whoa, okay. So I'm getting ready to meet him, and he's not Mexican. He's white. And I was like, you're white. How are you doing this? So I started asking him a lot of questions, and let me tell you, that man is knowledgeable about this holiday. Yeah.
And you know, what I thought one of the beautiful parts of the story, too, is the fact that he had been approached by Mexicans, and who had really appreciated everything that he's done to really bring this tradition here to South Florida.
Yeah. So one of my questions to him was, have you gotten criticism? I mean, obviously, you're not Mexican. And, you know, what is the feedback that you've gotten back from the Mexican-American community, or the Mexican community here in South Florida? And there's a woman who approached him and was just like, he told me, like, she was crying. And then, you know, and she told him, thank you for doing this. And I was like, okay, you're telling me that that woman said that. Let me ask other Mexican-Americans in that community who have attended. And a lot of them, you know, I put this inquiry on Facebook, and I was like, hey, do y'all know of Day of the Dead Festival in Fort Lauderdale? So many people reached out to me and were like, yes, it is amazing. They have all our traditions. They do, you know, there's Mexican folkloric dancers, there's mariachi bands, there's all of these things that make us proud Mexicanos.
And you know what's interesting is, and you remember this because we were talking about it here in the newsroom, you kept telling us, you kept telling me and Chris Remington, you guys, you should watch that movie, the Disney movie Coco.
Yes.
Because it's about the Day of the Dead.
Yeah, and I think that movie is beautiful. I cried so much because of that movie, because it represented what Day of the Dead is, and it represented what I grew up with. That culture, the flowers, the, you know, just everything was what I grew up with, and I had never seen that in a movie.
All right, something you said a second ago, which I thought, wait a second, hold on. Laugh at death. This has to do with the calaveras?
Yes.
Okay. And there's this aspect of the holiday where you were telling me about how you're laughing at death. So your mom sent you something recently
about this.
Okay, what is this real quickly?
So since we were little, my mom, you know, we have to laugh at death. This is what we do. So they are called calaveritas literarias. Literary skulls is a direct translation. And, you know, it's just a little story, a little saying where you laugh at death.
And she sent this to you. We'll play a little bit of this.
Calaveritas, calaveritas, para mi niña favorita. Ya llegué después de un año, recién vengo de la tumba. Vengo a invitarte, Alejandra, acompáñame a la zumba. Traigo dos libras.
What is she saying there?
She's just like, calaveras, skulls, skulls, death people, death people. You know, you've sent my daughter to South Florida. And basically, it's just like, you've sent my daughter to South Florida. You're having fun with her. Enjoy her. You know, be with her during this day. All our, you know, people who have passed away. And then it's kind of laughing at it. And then she's going to die. Or it's like, it's just a little saying, like, we're going to go out to eat. We're going to go out dance. We're going to go do all these things. And then she's going to die. Ha, 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 ha. It's just kind of like a little tale, a little saying that they do to little kids. So they're like, we do all these fun things. And we're going to die, but that's okay because that's a normal, this is part of life.
So I wonder, it's not so much that you're laughing at death, but it's just it's a certain way that, you know, within the Mexican tradition, how you view death.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what are you going to be doing? So today is actually the first day and there's another day tomorrow. Why is it over 2 days, by the way?
So the first day, they say it's Día de los Angelitos, Day of the Angels, Day of the Innocents. So all those young kids, little kids and little girls who've passed away, they're considered innocent and free of sin. So they honor them on the first day. The second day is an overall, just everyone who has passed away. So that's why it's 2 days.
All right. So basically say, Feliz Día de los Muertos.
Feliz Día de los Muertos. Thank you.
Alejandra Martinez, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Luis.
Check out her story, by the way. Go to WLRN.org and check out her story about how she found a group here in South Florida celebrating the Day of the Dead. Well, that's our program for today, this first day of Día de los Muertos, this Thursday, November 1st. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday. Thank you.